got tapped here about 1:30 or 2 o'clock.
Went into the frame like this, and it shot a beam of light at the warhead.
The lighting emanated from the fabric of the craft.
Do you get a direction on them?
Now, remember, all this stuff is flying at several thousand miles an hour. So this thing fires a beam of light at the warhead, hits it, fires another beam of light, and then flies out the way it came in.
I went around and started doing a 360 walk around the area, taking recording my observations. I was looking underneath the craft like that. I had taken quite detailed notes on that.
When the lights came on, Major Mansman turned around and looked at me and said, "Were you guys screwing around up there?" And I said, "No, sir." And he said, "What was that?" And I said, "It looks to me like we got a UFO."
I measured probably about 9 feet long, maybe 6 feet high, a little higher, maybe 6.5 feet.
I was never satisfied with the explanation that they were high-altitude flares. It didn't look like that. They were too, it was all too symmetrical. I mean, it clearly had a shape to it, and a big shape, and it was a constant shape. And you can't control flares that way. There's just no way they would flare.
You go into space.
Our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world.
And now, Dark Matters. Here's Don Ecker.
You are listening to Dark Matters Radio. And yes, I realize that several months ago, I made a very public announcement that as an active investigator, researcher, somebody that has been looking into the UFO field for over 20 years, that I was leaving. However, I did leave the caveat that if something popped up that piqued my interest, that I would not for one second hesitate to talk about it on the radio. Well, guess what? Something has popped up. It has piqued my interest. And that's what we're going to be talking about on this show. The name of the documentary, Out of the Blue, The Definitive Investigation of the UFO Phenomenon, narrated by none other than Peter Coyote. And the executive producer, none other than Mr. James Fox, who was joining us right here on Dark Matters, and his assistant was Tim Coleman. And James, welcome to the show. A number of years ago, I had some dealings with Tim. I haven't talked to him in a long time, but when you talk to him again, please give him my regards.
I will definitely do that.
Well, Out of the Blue, James, this is an absolutely, and you're talking to somebody that has been banging around this field for a long time. This literally excited me when I watched it last night. I don't say that lightly, nor do I say that about very many things, but your documentary did exactly that. Now, before we really get into the documentary, let me ask you this. UFOs. My Lord, there are so many other things that probably are deserving of a documentary effort. What caused you to jump into this admittedly crazy, confusing field?
Well, I had a sighting of something about 14, 15 years ago. I was with a handful of friends of mine. So there were five of us all in total. And it was a very exciting sighting, but when I came home and shared the story with my close friends and family, they all kind of laughed at me. And of course, the first thing they said is, you know, what kind of drugs are you guys on? And I found that very frustrating that if my close friends and family couldn't believe me, then who would?
You mean the skeptical reaction you got to it?
The knee-jerk reaction, yes. And so I started to look into it, investigate it a little further. And as soon as I scratched the surface, I realized there's a lot more to it than what we're being told. And, you know, I think that we can all agree that if it were true that some UFOs could be of extraterrestrial origin, I think that'd be a very, I'm speaking hypothetically here, that would be a very amazing and profound discovery.
Well, at the very least, I guess.
Yeah, you know, it's something that sort of transcends religion and boundaries and politics. Something that we're all entitled to know about and curious about. And I think there's a lot of truth to it. And so, I couldn't let it go.
Well, now you managed to interview and get on camera some absolutely outstanding, stellar people. People like Colonel Gordon Cooper, former governor of Arizona, Fife Symington, now deceased, unfortunately, Lieutenant Colonel Philip Corso. And I'm talking about some names that are absolutely beyond any doubt giants when it comes to witness testimony and so forth in this field. Has it bothered you that with people of such stature that more in the mainstream media have not sat up and taken notice of this? Do you believe that whatever forces that be have done such an outstanding job of basically submerging this field that is almost as if it's impossible to break a story like this in the mainstream?
Well, you bring up an interesting point, and it's something that was said by Buzz Aldrin on the Larry King Show. By the way, we're going to be on Larry King again this Saturday at 6 p.m. Buzz Aldrin says, well, surely if this is true, there'd be a lot of military people coming forward and talking about it. And I had to interrupt him on the show, and I said, well, they have, and they are. And it seems to be, their testimony seems to be falling on deaf ears. So I challenge anyone listening to this program right now, is what I say, for any, particularly any media out there, if you have any doubt whatsoever about the validity to this subject matter, just watch Out of the Blue. Contact me from my website, outoftheblue.com, and I will send any media out there listening to this interview a free complimentary preview copy of the film, so we can dispel the myth once and for all that there aren't any credible eyewitness testimonies out there.
Well, your documentary is literally chocked full of not only military people, but James, you have three former presidents of the United States on this documentary speaking about this subject. Presidents Gerry Ford, Jimmy Carter, and Ronald Reagan. Now, good heaven, you don't get much hype than former presidents of the United States, do you?
No, you know, we actually got very close to Clinton as well. I talked to Webb Hubble. You know, he wrote that book, Friends in High Places, in which he makes the comment that, that Clinton wanted him to look into who killed JFK and are UFOs real. And I contacted Webb Hubble about that, and you know, he said, well, I put everything in the book that I knew about it, that, you know, he basically, you know, validated that statement, and then he said, I suggest you talk to Clinton. We actually wrote Clinton a letter, and we received a response from NASA about it. And it was an interesting response, because NASA didn't deny or accept the existence of UFOs. They just questioned as to whether UFOs were related to aliens, which I thought was a very interesting response.
I've got to think back to 1976 when then-Governor Jimmy Carter was running on the Democratic ticket for President of the United States. One of his campaign promises was that if I am elected, I will open all the files on the UFO subject to the public. Now, of course, we all know that that never happened. No one that I'm aware of ever really got a good reason why. But my reason for mentioning this is back in the early 1990s, when I was doing my first radio show, UFOs Tonight, on the cable radio network, I had occasion to meet a gentleman who was friends with a then-retired Secret Service agent. This Secret Service agent, according, now you have to understand, this story is coming to me secondhand, but this person that I was talking to had a great interest in this subject and field, and part of it went back to the Clinton years. And he told me that his buddy, the former Secret Service agent, had been on Carter's security detail. And after Carter was elected, sworn into office, and was getting all the initial presidential briefings, he went into one briefing that was allegedly on this subject, or at least it dealt in part with this subject. And we have to keep in mind that Carter has always expressed a very evangelical type of Christianity. And according to this Secret Service agent, when Carter left that briefing, he came out literally, James, with tears coming down his face. And during the rest of his time in office, he never again publicly acknowledged anything about the UFO subject. Now, that was a rather astounding story.
You know, we actually got him, as you probably noticed, in Out of the Blue, at a book signing at Stacy's Bookstore in San Francisco, to admit having not only seen a UFO, we all knew that he saw one, but he actually admits it on camera, but the fact that he made inquiries during the, when he was president, into the subject matter. And I think his response was, basically, they made inquiries, but they got a number of different responses.
Well, NASA went out of its way to shuffle off that immediately. They wanted nothing to do with it. And NASA, of course, was who originally Carter wanted to take over this investigation. But as you point out in your documentary, a military officer, I believe an Air Force officer, wrote a letter or memo strongly recommending against it.
Yes. You know, and I was very fortunate to get a hold of some of those documents. I think I was doing an interview with, I want to say it was Haynes, or perhaps it was Peter Sturrock. But they said that they had all the original correspondence that took place during his administration in the 70s with NASA and the Air Force. And so we do feature some of those documents, as you just pointed out, in Out of the Blue.
Absolutely. Look, let's take a very quick break here. And when we come back, more with my interview with, of course, Mr. James Fox, who is the executive producer of the new, and it's an award-winning documentary, Out of the Blue. Back in a moment.
Visit the Dark Matters website at www.darkmattersradio.com.
Have you ever wondered about the possibility that the human race is not alone in the universe? Trace evidence and eyewitness accounts of the unusual over the millennia have suggested that we're not. The evidence is staring us all in the face, but on some level of consciousness, we're in denial despite eyewitness accounts and highly documented events. There are a few people who have the courage to step up to the potential implications of these occurrences and address them head on. One group has made the choice to risk it all to bring you in-depth information on these subjects. UFODepot.com. It's the only place on the internet that you can find these subjects covered in an in-depth manner. For years, UFODepot.com has offered rare and hard-to-find items covering the subjects of the highly unidentified and the unknown. Visit them today online at www.ufodepot.com. A universal awareness is just around the corner. Cut through all the conspiracy and the hype by visiting UFODepot.com today.
Today, the great fear is Al-Qaeda. Americans across the nation fear another 9/11 type attack by fanatics using nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons. Yet the little-known fact is Al-Qaeda is practically an American intelligence creation. In the 1980s, we armed, trained, and supplied the very same people who today are trying to destroy this country. The weapon that we pointed at the Soviet Union came back to haunt and hunt America. This is the story about another weapon that American intelligence procured in the fight against the communists. A biological weapon that turned itself against the very people who tried to harness and then use it. It escaped, and now not only are the weapons handlers at risk, but every human being on the planet, because The men in power forgot one very important fact. When you ask the devil to dance, he always calls the tune. Past Sins, a novel of supernatural horror. Sometimes there really are scary things in the dark. Go to www.pastsins.net.
This year, more than 172,000 people will be told they have lung cancer. 60% will wonder why, as they never smoked or quit smoking years ago. Lung cancer will kill 163,000 people this year, making it America's number one cancer killer. But there is hope. New treatments are available, and more are on the way. Lung Cancer Alliance is the only organization dedicated to providing support for people touched by lung cancer. Join us in the fight against lung cancer. Visit lungcanceralliance.org.
This is the Patriots Brigade Radio Network, waging war on the matrix of confusion.
Baby Grace is the victim. She was 14 years of age. And the wheels are turning, turning. For the finger points at me. But I have not been to Oxford Town. All is well. But I have not been to Oxford Town. So hold the bell. Watch the days go by. All is well. 23rd century dies. And the prison priests are decent. My attorney seems sincere.
My guest, Mr. James Fox, executive producer of the award-winning documentary Out of the Blue. I just watched this last evening, and I've got to tell you, literally, it excited me. James, you zero in on several cases in this documentary. Of course, Roswell is hit upon. And that is what the perennial. Everybody knows about Roswell. The Bentwaters case, not nearly as much. Let's talk about that for a little bit, because Bentwaters, which back in Christmas 1980 was a forward American tactical air base that housed nuclear weapons in the event of a Soviet invasion of Western Europe, Bentwaters would have been one of the places that would have been called upon to respond. And right before Christmas, or right around Christmas, they had a rather astounding incident happen. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, we managed for the first time to get all three airmen on one of the biggest sightings the first night of the craft that was actually landed. You know, we got Cabansag, Burroughs, and Peniston were the first airmen to respond. Peniston was sergeant that responded to an alleged downed aircraft. So I think it's very important that, you know, I got all the key players on that particular night to testify all together, and it was amazing because, as you probably noticed in the film, they would finish each other's sentences. You know.
Yeah. Whatever happened to them, it profoundly affected them.
Yes, so anyway, they went out to investigate an alleged downed aircraft, and as they approached the Rendlesham Forest area, Peniston points out that they, and as well as Cabansag and Burroughs, that they quickly realized that it was nothing of that they'd seen ever before, and they approached the craft. It was a landed craft. And I think Burroughs even actually made a funny comment. He said he asked about, and he mentions this in the movie, he asked about this crashed craft, and the response, I guess, from the tower was, "It didn't crash, sir." And he said, "Well, what did it do?" And he said, "It landed, sir." So I think their interest at that point was piqued. And as they approached the object, I think Cabansag actually was, they started having a lot of radio interference. Cabansag was sent back to act as a relay between the base and the forest. And Burroughs and Peniston proceeded to investigate this object, this landed object. And, you know, Pennington and Burroughs' description of this thing sitting on the ground is truly phenomenal.
Well, Pennison even admits to having walked up to it and touching the landed craft, whatever it was.
He kept his original logbook from that evening, which he shared with me, and I had him flip through the pages and describe it in the movie. But yeah, and he even copied down some of the symbols, or all the symbols that were on the, that he saw on the side of the craft, as well as he touched the craft, and he describes the, you know, the texture and the fact that it was warm. And I think it was about a 40-45 minute on-ground investigation.
Now, what I found very astounding about this, James, is the fact that the then authorities that be tried to pass this off as the infamous lighthouse beacon. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and you hear Burroughs and Penniston, as well as Cabansag, respond to that allegation, which is absolutely absurd. You know, Penniston saying, how could anyone, you know, you could see if it was a distant light off, a light off in the distance, how one may be to be able to confuse it with a lighthouse beacon, but they were sitting right by this thing. I mean, it's just absolutely absurd. And keep in mind that you know, Penniston's job, as well as Burroughs, is to provide security for a base that housed nuclear weapons.
Well, that's something that for a very long time the American government denied was there because of all the, I don't know how many people will recall that back in the very early 80s, there was an extraordinarily strong anti-nuclear movement in Europe.
Yeah, well, I even think, even to this day, you know, I interviewed Holt as well, who's the deputy base commander, and I think they all but say nuclear weapons. I think they say they were housing weapons that were of the utmost importance or of security.
Well,
so there seems to be a reluctance even to this day to them to overtly talk about the nuclear weapons that were housed there. But you know, Holt talks about a second or third night, on the second or third night, and Burroughs was with Holt then as well, that these objects were doing what he called a grid pattern. There were several of them up in the sky above them, silently maneuvering through the sky, shooting beams of light down into the bunkers.
Well, I was going to mention that, as a matter of fact, the series of sightings did not just happen on one night, but over a series of nights. But, you know, some of the more mundane security concerns at that time, at that location, in the event of war, these people knew that they were very likely to be placed under attack by landed Soviet special forces. If they could break in there and neutralize those weapons, I mean, that was one of their very real concerns of, you know, talking about the security of that base. So any incursion into that area would be a security concern of the highest order.
You know, that's a very interesting statement because, you know, the British government as well as the American government put out a press release that nothing of any national security interest took place. And I think that Admiral Lord Hill Norton puts it best when he says, you know, you've either got two options. One is that the Colonel Holt and all of his men were hallucinating, in which case, you know, when there are nuclear-armed weapons at the base is of utmost security concern. And if they say, you know, if what happened, if what they say happened, that, of course, too, is of utmost security concern, national security concern. So either way, you know, their response is just doesn't add up.
No, it doesn't, and it never has. Well, one of the other cases that you talk about, and of course this is, I guess one could say, maybe even a little cynically, the mother of all UFO cases, is what happened at Roswell. Now, you got a gentleman on record that I personally have had the highest regard for many years, Colonel Philip Corso, a man that has been maligned by many people over the years, that he was a Walter Mitty type, that he was delusional, or perhaps he was suffering, you know, Alzheimer's, my God, who knows what. But that man was the real McCoy. You had contact with him, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Did you see that? Did you watch the second disc?
No, I didn't.
Tears of Denial?
No, I didn't.
When you have a moment, check that out, because I actually brought some of those issues up with him. We were in the hangar. It was the 50th anniversary of the Roswell event in 1997. And I had to elbow my way up to him through a crowd of newsmen. And I said, you know, basically, what do you say to those people who are criticizing what you're doing? And he looks right in the camera and he kind of stops everything else that he's doing. And sorry, I just had a FedEx gentleman arrive with a package and I had to... his response was, hey, were you there with me? Did you have the clearances? Were you cleared? They can't answer those questions. All they do is criticize with no evidence. And he really makes this statement. It's a very emotional statement that he makes directly to the camera. And, you know, I also sat with him with his grandchildren, putting his hands around his arms around his grandchildren, talking about one of the reasons why he's coming forward. And I know that there were a lot of discrepancies in his book, which he pointed out to me, that the book went to print by Bill Burns prior to, you know, having him screen it. And he was very upset about that. And I know that a lot of people out there are trying to debunk, you know, his claims as a result of some of the discrepancies in his book. So it's one point that I would like to make that he shared with me before he died.
Well, when you see, now I first became aware of Colonel Corso quite a few years ago when I became privy to some of his testimony he made before the Senate on armed forces issues. Corso was very concerned, and rightly so, I might add, James, on issues involving POWs and MIAs that have been missing going all the way back to the Second World War, literally to World War II, which is now well over 60 years ago. And Corso was also concerned, and he made this very clear, that there were certain American intelligence institutions that he felt had been infiltrated rather successfully by our potential enemy, the Soviet Union, back in the 50s and 60s. So now, when you look at the responsible positions that this man held, and when you and I were talking several days ago, and I had mentioned, well, the armed forces, the Army, will not give command of a nuclear weapons battery to an officer if they feel that the man is a loose cannon. And in Europe, in the late 50s, Corso commanded nuclear weapons, and in the event of war, he had the personal authorization and authority to release those weapons if he felt the need arose. Now, that, I mean, just that should tell people that this guy was the real McCoy.
Well, you know, it's interesting that Senator Strom Thurmond initially wrote the foreword to his book.
Well, you know, there was a lot of criticism about that also that came from Thurmond's office.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm aware of the backstory. Thurmond and he were good friends. They had known each other for many, many years. And... as a matter of fact, even Bill Burns told me when he was co-writing this book with Corso that Thurmond himself was calling this the Roswell book. And later his staff tried to say, no, he was writing another book, They Walk with Giants, or I Walk with Giants, and that's the foreword that Thurmond wrote. But it wasn't. It was for this particular book.
Yeah, it's interesting that he recanted those statements.
Well, I don't know if it was Thurmond so much as it was his staff. Well,
right.
Now tell me, during the course of the work that you put into this documentary, did you encounter any roadblocks?
I encountered nothing but roadblocks. I mean, it was an uphill battle the whole way. I mean,
in what regard?
Trying to get access, interviews. I mean, I could tell you there's a story behind each and every interview in the film. I mean, you know, you've got, you know, Joe Public, which is me, trying to access these military witnesses. I don't have a reputable news organization behind me at all. They didn't, you know, of course, the first 5, 6, 7 years, they didn't know who I was. The letter of denials I got from everyone, from Carter, Ford, I mean, it's just, the list just goes was on, including Admiral Norhill Norton. That was one of the most difficult interviews to obtain.
Really?
But it was an uphill battle the whole way. I mean, funding issues and logistics and bickering in the editing room with my two co-producers, even though I represent 55% of the company, there was a two-thirds majority. And I felt it very, very important, if we're going to create a body of evidence to be presented to mainstream media, that we take a very, very conservative path with this film. And you know, UFOs and flying saucers, however you want to say it, is a very fringe subject.
Well, let's say esoteric.
Esoteric, yes, that's even better. So, you know, I felt that there was any sort of question as to someone's credibility, I just would rather just cut them out of the documentary altogether. And there were a number of cases where I had to really argue my position with my two co-producers. And every aspect of the production was an uphill battle.
Well, now, going back to 1997, another case that you thoroughly cover is the infamous Phoenix Lights case. Now, back during that period of time, my wife Vicki and I were very deeply involved in this investigation. We did several issues where large parts of UFO magazine was devoted to the Phoenix Lights. I personally spoke to several Air Force spokespeople down there, really got, I guess you could say, a runaround. The skeptics were maintaining for a very long time that, hey, look, all that was up there were flares, you know, there was a flare drop, blah, blah, blah. But yet you had hundreds and perhaps thousands of residents of Phoenix that were telling a completely different story. Then, James, the governor holds a press conference and turns the whole thing into a laughingstock, which really upset a lot of folks. Now, what can you tell us about that?
Well, that upset me a lot. I mean, I was really disturbed by that little stunt he pulled at the, earlier that day, he held a press conference and where he stated unequivocally that he was going to get to the bottom of it, and he seemed very serious. He was going to contact people at Luke Air Force Base and I think the Department of Public Safety and find out if it was a real UFO. So later that afternoon, when he has his unscheduled press conference where he's got, you know, one of his aides dressed up in an alien suit, comes out and makes a joke out of the whole event, was at the very least very, very disappointing, and I was very upset by that. Well, about close to 10 years later, I'm reading an article in a local newspaper. It's got a clip about Symington, former governor of Arizona, is now operating a culinary school. I'm saying roughly 10 years, could have been 8 years. So I sort of planted the seed in my mind that, all right, well, now he's obviously no longer a politician. I'd like to approach him and see if he could, why he did what he did. So I sent him a copy of an older version of Out of the Blue, and thinking I had a snowball's chance in hell to get him to cooperate with me. He watched the movie and he got back to me immediately and said, yes, I'd love to meet with you. Now, I had no idea what he was going to reveal, but of course I responded immediately and we were arranged for a meeting as well as an interview, on-camera interview at his home in Santa Barbara. He's back and forth between Phoenix and Santa Barbara. Got the camera crew together. I think I responded within 24 hours. I was on my way down to Santa Barbara. Way down there, I contacted one of his former constituents as well as a witness to the event, Stacy Rhodes, and I told her about what was happening. I said, would you like to say anything to the governor? She said, you bet I would. So I took out my little pocket tape recorder and I recorded. I pulled the car over to the side of the road and I recorded with my cell phone a statement to Stacy Rhodes to be presented to him. And she really lays into him. So we set up can we meet with him? We set up the cameras. I have no idea what he's going to reveal. I have no idea what he saw or didn't see or what happened. We start the interview and, I think about a couple minutes into it, I said, oh, you know, I've got a little something I'd like to play for you. And mind you, the cameras are rolling. He's sitting down and I pull out my tape, my pocket tape recorder, and, you know, I press play, and he starts to squirm a little in his seat. He says, boy, it's been a while since I've been put on the spot like this. And there is Stacey Rhodes really laying into him. Why the hell, basically, why the hell did you do what you did? You know, you really offended a lot of us. We've maintained, we've stuck to our story this whole time, and do you still think this is a matter of ridicule? And at that point, you know, he reveals to us that, which was to my amazement, the cameras are rolling, that he not only launched a full-blown investigation into this event, this alleged craft, but that he, too, himself, and remember, he's a captain in the Air Force as well as a pilot, saw this thing, and that he felt in his gut that it was otherworldly, I think is how he phrased it, otherworldly, just because of the size. So you just knew, with, you know, immediately seeing this thing. So that was a major revelation and a boon to out of the blue, and I think it gave that whole Phoenix case a boost as well as some closure.
Well, why? Okay, that gets us back to the original question: why did he try to make this into a laughingstock?
Okay, and I've asked him this on a number of occasions because I really want to get to the bottom of it, and his response to me, and sincere response, I believe, because I thought he got a phone call. I was convinced of it. And I kept saying to him, you sure he didn't get a phone call? And I've said this to him at a dinner, just the two of us. He says, no, he said there was mounting hysteria. And I was really concerned about this mounting hysteria and pandemonium, in my state. I didn't mean to make fun of everyone. I just wanted to add some levity to this mounting hysteria.
Well, now, you know, this, of course, could bring up an entire slew of new questions. But the thing that I have found with most politicians, James, they seem to forget that they are, in essence, working for you and I. And when we have sincere considerations about something, or in this case, perhaps even for about an unknown something, that it behooves them to try to get to the bottom of it. And, you know, in a case like this, now I know I have, in the past, I have talked to many folks down in Arizona about this situation that happened back in 1997, and almost to a person, they were just thoroughly outraged. They felt that they had been marginalized when, in fact, they underwent an extraordinary experience.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I investigated, I mean, I interviewed a lot of the witnesses. I mean, and that's one of the things I point out quite often is people keep referring to as the Phoenix Lights. Well, one of the people I interviewed said they think they could have hit it with a rock. It was so low. This was a structured craft. And I think this is my own personal speculation or theory, is that this craft flew over around 8:30, 8:45, and that, you know, obviously the phone lines to the local Air Force base were probably blowing up, according to some witnesses. And the Air Force's response to it was probably to send up some A-10 Warthogs and drop some flares over that one mountain range. So around 10 o'clock, by the time they got that up, made that happen, that kind of created a diversion. So they could indeed prove that there were flares up in the sky that night. And that's one of the things I've just recently done it. Are you familiar with James McGaha?
Oh, yes. My God, yes. Big
okay,
skeptic.
Well, I contacted James McGaha just recently, and I sent him yesterday a copy of Out of the Blue, and what I said to him is that I'm curious, Mr. McGaha, as to whether or not your explanation of A-10 Warthogs could be applied to my witnesses. Because, and he actually got back to me and sent me his address, and I sent him a copy of Out of the Blue yesterday. So, because, you know, I mean, it's absolutely absurd. I mean, it's just apples and oranges.
Absolutely. Look, we're going to take another very quick break. And when we come back, more with my very special guest, Mr. James Fox, executive producer of Out of the Blue. Get it? Watch it. Oh, when we come back, I'm going to tell you where you can get it. Stand by.
you ready for some adventure? Swashbuckling action? Pirates? High seas battles? How about a little history, romance, and haunting Celtic mysticism thrown into the mix? If so, you have got to read The Rollicking Adventures of Tam O'Hare, the new book by author-illustrator Scotty Roberts. Set in England, Ireland, and Scotland of the 16th century, Irish Lord Tam O'Hare sets out on a quest to find and rescue a little girl from the hands of the very folk of the Dark Shadowlands. On his way, he runs headlong into adventure and intrigue from all quarters in the form of wolves, foxes, and pirating rabbits. Oh, and did I mention Tam O'Hare is, well, a rabbit? This book will not be available in stores until late this fall. But you can get your advance copy of The Rollicking Adventures of Tam O'Hare now by going to www.tamohare.com. That's www.tamohare.com. The Rollicking Adventures of Tam O'Hare. You'll never trust a raccoon with a sword again.
Lan Lamphere here from The Edge, heard on the Patriot Brigade Radio Network, here with a special message for preparedness. The Secretary of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff, recently made statements to the effect that this summer, the United States may see an influx of violence by terrorist Muslims in our homeland. The Patriot Brigade has been saying this for months due to the illusion of security in our country that's been propagated by the mainstream media. Now we've decided to do something about it. We recently began to seek out and endorse products that you need to help keep yourself safe and comfortable in an emergency situation. One of those products is WaterSafe, and joining me now is Kristen Neville, Operations Manager for WaterSafe at MyWaterSafe.com. Kristen, tell me a little bit about your product and why it's so helpful in an emergency.
Well, my product is called the WaterSafe. It comes in three different sizes, but why it's so important for people to have it now to prepare is because it can keep a water supply safe and secure for 3 to 5 weeks or even longer.
How does your product work?
Well, the one that people absolutely love the most is called the WaterSafe bathtub model, and it holds 65 gallons of water. What people do is they pull it out of the package, place it into the bathtub, and then fill it up through a very special sleeve. They can fill the water. The WaterSafe will hold as much water as their bathtub can actually hold.
You can't live without water. How much does something like this cost?
The WaterSafe bathtub model costs $29.99. And it can be found at MyWaterSafe.com, and they're in several retail stores.
Kristen, thanks for helping me by sharing your product with our audience. I can't stress enough how important it is to keep yourself ready for an emergency. Water is something that we all take for granted, and in an emergency, that is a luxury we simply cannot afford. Visit MyWaterSafe.com and spend a few extra dollars to ensure your water supply when it seems the whole world is crumbling around you. I'm going to say it again, MyWaterSafe.com. Visit their website, buy their products. You will not live to regret it.
July 8, 1947, the Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
Loud and clear. 7, go ahead.
I'm talking at 10 o'clock high.
This is Houston. Say again, 7.
So we have a bogey at 10 o'clock high.
Right here.
What I consider normal fear to be is something that you expect. You only should. But this was something that wasn't supposed to even exist.
Stationary. He's about 8 to 10 miles, and he looks like he's coming right at us.
It's fear that you can't even explain.
We got traffic here about 1:30 or 2 o'clock. It's very bright. Doesn't seem to be moving. Just a change of colors. I don't think it's a star.
Something is visiting us and trying to wake us up to their presence.
That'd be kind of interesting to have a couple pictures.
If
I think it might make our case a little better.
UFOs, it would cause widespread panic and fear a la the War of the Worlds.
Our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world.
Space is open to us now, and our eagerness to share its meaning is not governed by the efforts of others. We go into space because whatever mankind must undertake, free men must fully share.
People on the earth, can you hear me? Came a voice from the sky on a magical night. And in the colors of a thousand sunsets, they traveled to the world on a silvery light. The people of the earth stood waiting, watching as the ships came one by one. Setting fire to the sky as they landed, carrying to the world children of the sun.
This is the Patriots Brigade Radio Network, waging war on the matrix of confusion.
All at once came a sound from inside. Then a beam of light hit the ground. Everyone felt the sound of their heartbeat. Every man, every woman, every child. They passed the limits of imagination to the door, to the world of another time. And on the journey of a thousand lifetimes, with the children of the sun, they started to climb.
Before we get back to James, let me give you a little information. If you are with any media, go up to James's website and let me give you that URL. It's, and you ready to copy down? Here we go. Out of the blue, the movie, all one word, out of the blue, the movie, .com. Now, if you are with media, contact James. He will send you a special review copy. All you'll have to do is tell him what organization you're with and give him an address to send it to, and he will do that. Is that correct, James?
Absolutely, I will do that. And I have been doing that.
And if you are of the public, and I can, and you have an interest in this UFO subject, I cannot stress highly enough this movie. And believe me, I have been around the old UFO track for over 20 years. This literally excited me when I watched it last night. There is some absolutely mind-blowing stuff in there. Over the years, I've covered God knows how many stories, how many investigations, and a number of those investigations I was intimately aware of, and it still excited the hell out of me. James, one of the cases going back many years, and right now I am having a hard time remembering the witness's name, but it took place up at Big Sur, the Air Force cameraman that was filming the rocket launch with the UFO that came in into the game and shot the damn rocket down.
Yeah, there was Robert Salas with the Minuteman missiles, and that was in Montana. That was one case, and then the other one is gosh, now you've got me struggling for his name. I'll think of it in a minute.
Yeah, but it was
a case. The film footage where the they had the telescopes on it.
Yes.
Yeah, the BU telescopes, and that was over Big Sur where they shot this thing from. It was an Atlas rocket.
Right.
I'll remember his name in a minute.
Well, this is a case when this first broke a number of years ago. There were a lot of people in this field that were absolutely okay.
Jacobs.
There were a lot of people in this field that were absolutely shocked by that, especially in light of 60-plus years of government denial that UFOs have ever presented any national security concerns. And, I mean, anybody with a half ounce of gray matter knows that that is absolute crap. Now, you mentioned the 1967 case with Colonel Salas.
Colonel Salas, yeah.
Are you familiar with the case that happened up there again in 1975?
At the same location?
Right. They ended up having to absolutely, totally replace a missile. The missile was unusable after the incursion. Now, Here's a couple of names. You probably are familiar with them, but I'm going to give you a couple of names of some two top-notch researchers that wrote an absolutely mind-blowing book, all based, I might add, on military incursions, Barry Greenwood and Larry Fawcett. The name of their book was Clear Intent. And as a matter of fact, when...
Like taking matches out of the hands of a baby.
Yes. When I first became involved in this field, and you may not be aware of this, but I was involved because initially with cattle mutilations. Back in the early 80s, I investigated as a lead criminal investigator two cattle mutilations. Years later, while I was doing some research, I
came... Was that with Linda Moulton Howe, or is that independent?
Independent.
Okay.
No, I did it as a police officer.
Oh, okay.
So years later, I came across some references to purported human mutilations, and I started an intensive 3-year investigation into that. And as a matter of fact, you can still find one of my very first papers I wrote on mutilations. Somebody put it up on the web many years ago. Well, at any rate, Larry Fawcett, one of the two authors of Clear Intent, at the time was still an active-duty police lieutenant. And when these cases happened up in Montana, Fawcett had gone up there. He was interfacing with a Montana County sheriff up there. And they had a huge map with all kinds of pins all over this map, James. And each pin represented a different phenomenon. One Keller was for animal mutilations. Another Keller of pin was for UFO sightings. Another Keller pin represented UFO touchdowns. And sure, at the time, this was all very hush hush. Now I know Fawcett, and Fawcett I would trust with my life. Okay, he's that kind of guy. So. At any rate, Larry said, and he knew about the paper I had written on human missions, and he said, well, you know, Don, he said, and I was looking at this map, and all these pins were up there, and he said, I noticed one pin with one Keller on it, pink, the only one that was on the map. So I turned to, and I forget the sheriff's name now, James, but I have it in my records. He said, I turned to him, and I said, well, what pin is that, or what Keller does that represent? And he said, he turned to me, and in a very low voice, he said, well, he said, Larry, that's a human mutilation, but we're not going to talk about that. And that blew Fawcett's mind. And he told me about it. And of course, after 3 years of beating my head on a brick wall, I finally dropped it. I couldn't get anywhere with it. But I had been warned off by somebody down in Florida about pursuing this thing. This was after I was in it for about a year and a half, but I kept it up for another year and a half or two. And there were even during the Hudson Valley. Do you recall reading about the Hudson Valley?
Hudson Valley sightings by Dr. Dalen Hynek, didn't he? Or
Hynek?
Yeah, didn't Dr. Dalen Hynek write about that?
Hynek, Bob Pratt, and Phil Imbrogno.
Okay.
And during that,
wasn't that crap similar to the one that was witnessed over Phoenix?
Yeah, it was a huge thing.
Yeah.
And not only that, but that craft, according to Imbrogno and Bob Pratt, now by the time I was involved, Hynek had died. So there was no way I could talk to Hynek, but I talked to Imbrogno and I talked to Bob Pratt before he died. And they told me that according to former security personnel at the Indian Point nuclear power plant, on one of these incursions, this thing flew in and shut down their entire security system. Now, this was shocking, to say the least. But this was one hell of a series of situations that were happening that went on for several years. I mean, this was not a quick hit and miss. The thing, there were problems back there for about 3 or 4 years.
Wow. It's interesting that, you know, when you have something that recurring like that. I mean, for instance, even the Bentwaters case, that was over several nights. And, you know, I just talked to a witness when I was down in Roswell last week, and they said that it was kind of known that for 3 weeks after the crash, there were UFOs hovering over the crash site, shooting beams of light down at the crash site.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, now, last week, as we do this show, you were on Larry King Live.
Yes.
Larry King, over the years, has done a number of UFO-themed programs. But you guys, when you were on last week, there were quite a few heavy hitters in there. You were there. Astronaut Buzz Aldrin was in there. Stanton Friedman was in there. Former Governor Fife Symington was in there. How do you feel overall that went? I watched it, James, and I personally think that King did a disservice by having too many people in there.
You know, King didn't organize that. I talked to the person that did organize it, and she definitely recognized it was just too many people. And I have a feeling nonetheless, it actually did really well in the
The ratings?
The ratings did really, really well. So they want to do something again, I think maybe in August. But, in which case we would make sure that would not repeat itself. But yeah, it was a bit of a circus, you know, and we were all under the impression that Buzz Aldrin was gonna, reveal, his sighting on the way to the moon and possibly something else. And then, you know, he just did a 180-degree turnaround. And it almost appeared to me, being there, I haven't watched the show yet, but that after King told him kind of to hurry up and get to the point, we went to a commercial break, and when we came back, because he was leading up to it quite well, I thought. Maybe he changed his mind, I don't know. But it all caught us off guard.
Well, one thing I picked up on, and, you know, having spent all those years as a cop, as a detective, and I learned how to listen to people, how to read between the lines, I could see that you were zeroing in on Aldrin, and King, for whatever reason, cut you off at the knees.
You know, because I had talked to Fife in the green room prior to the show, and I told Fife I have sources very close to him. Matter of fact, I'm friends with Buzz Aldrin's sister, who lives in my area. We've had lunch on a number of occasions, and she's shared with me stuff that he's told me. As a matter of fact, she helped me obtain an interview with him.
This is Buzz Aldrin's sister.
Buzz Aldrin's sister, yes. She lives in Marin County. But in any case, you know, I worked on a movie 14 years ago with Mickey Rooney, and I met his wife Jan Rooney and his son. And I also know a gentleman named by the name of Ron Jones, and they've all shared with me what Buzz has told them directly.
Ron Jones from Clear Lake?
You know, he just moved. I'm not sure where he's from now, but I think he worked on a book with Aldrin a couple of years back.
If it's who I'm thinking of, James, I interviewed him a number of years ago.
Oh, really?
If it's who I'm of.
Okay, well, but in any case, you know, Aldrin agreed to do an interview with me, knowing what the interview was about, and he said that he was on book tour, then he could meet in the south of France, Monte Carlo, and he gave me, you know, the location, everything, where to be. So I borrowed money, got a camera crew together, and jumped on an airplane and flew to the south of France. I waited 5 days. This is back in 1999, I believe. We waited 5 days, and Monte Carlo is a very expensive place, especially putting everybody up. You know, we were supposed to do the interview, I think it was on the Tuesday, and then by the time Thursday, Friday rolled around, I said, look, you know, we gotta do this. I can't wait here all week. And he said, well, meet me in my hotel lobby. So I went to his hotel. He said, don't have the cameras rolling. Don't, you know. I said, no, no problem. We'll have the cameras, you know, in their bags, whatever. And, then the receptionist came and notified me. He said, there's a phone call. And I went and I talked to, and it was Buzz, and he said, I can't do the interview. And I said, well, why is that? He said, Paul Allen, he said, first of all, how's my UFO experience going to change anything? And I told him that it takes people of your stature to come forward to elevate this whole thing to a more credible level. And they said, well, Paul Allen just invested in SETI and got labeled a UFO nut, and I'm trying to get funding to put citizens up into space to develop this rocket to enable citizens to go into space, and I'm not willing to jeopardize that initiative. And that was that.
You mean...
So he didn't deny the whole thing to me, and he said, how's my UFO experience going to change anything? So the fact that... And then I talked to his sister 2 days ago, and she's gonna contact him and find out why he did what he did.
Well, that oh my God, and
that's the honest to God truth. I'm not making this up.
Well, no, of course not. But I'm feeling bad for you for all the money you had to lay out.
Yeah, and you know, I never really got an apology or anything. And then when I saw him in the green room prior to going on Larry King, he acted like he didn't know me.
Is that right?
He acted like he didn't know me.
Well, did you remind him?
Of course I did. So I'm the one that flew down to the south of France, and you know
stood me up.
Yeah, I said, I know your sister, and I mentioned his sister, and I mentioned Mickey Rooney and everybody else. He just pretended like he didn't know me.
Oh, my God, James. Well, you know, I've had the same kind of thing happen over the years with people that have said they will be available for interviews and what have you, and at the last minute, they cut you off the knees. Well, now, they're going to be, as we do this show, they're going to be rerunning the Larry King thing on July 21st. Is that correct?
Yes.
So everybody will get a chance to, that may have missed it, will get a chance to see that.
You know, including myself, I haven't seen it yet. So I was a little nervous. I was a little nervous initially, but I think I finally got it together a little bit. But it was a bit of a circus.
Well,
but nevertheless, like I said, they said it got some of the best ratings of any show for Friday that they had this year.
Well, now, you've won a number of awards for this film, haven't you?
Yeah, we won a couple. We haven't entered it, the new version, in anything. You know, everyone's given us different advice. Some people are saying that we should consider a theatrical release. Or we should enter this in some film festivals.
I agree, by the way.
You know, which I think we do. I think it might be a little bit too long as it is now for a theatrical release. Maybe we could cut it down a little bit. What is it, like one hour 46 minutes, I believe?
Yeah, I personally by no way think it was too long, James.
Really?
I was disappointed when it was over, and that's the God's truth.
Really?
Yes, I was disappointed when it was over. Of course, you know, hey, you can't go by what I, because, you know, I've been in and around this field. There were a number of other areas I would have loved to have seen you cover. But I mean, realistically speaking, you know that there's only so much you can do in something like this. And you did one hell of a job, James. So let me be very upfront on that. You did one hell of a job.
I really do appreciate that. I mean, I can honestly tell you that it just about devastated every relationship I had. I went into major debt. My editor and I were speaking through lawyers for a couple of months, which is ridiculous. But it really pushed us all to the limit. I mean, it almost killed us.
Well, you know, I did back a number of years ago the very first review on Richard Dolan's UFOs in the National Security State. And I gave it my high recommendation. As a matter of fact, the new volume that he has out, part of my review is the very first thing you see when you open it up. And I said about that book that Dolan did the optimal thing for this generation of researchers. This book is an invaluable resource. Well, James, I feel the same way about your documentary. You have conducted an invaluable resource for anybody that has an interest in this subject.
Well, thank you so much. I really do appreciate that. And I feel very fortunate to have had the opportunity to do it, you know, and also to document some of the witnesses that are no longer with us.
Well, you see, that's the problem. And over the years, I've talked with many friends about that very thing. I really believe that whatever deep, dark bureaucracy that is behind this secret, I really, honest to God, believe that they are depending upon the passage of time, people dying, going away, becoming frustrated with this, that the basically topic will simply go away, and allow them to do whatever it is that they're doing in total secrecy.
Let me ask you a question, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Being a seasoned investigator on this phenomenon, why, in your opinion, is the U.S. government covering this up?
Well, several reasons. I think, first and foremost, because of potential problems with religion, with fundamentalists, I think this would be a shocking thing. Before I go into that, let me just say this to clarify what I'm about to say. Back in about 1992-93, I received a phone call from Richard Hoagland of the Face on Mars fame.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And Hoagland was working with Professor Stan McDaniel. And they were working to get NASA basically re-photograph Cydonia. They were going back to Mars with the Mars Observer. And NASA was playing it really close to the vest, and they didn't know if they'd even have a camera on board, if you can believe that.
Come on.
No, this is what Hoagland and McDaniel were told. So McDaniel was writing a paper, and it ended up being a devastating paper. And as a matter of fact, James, in that paper that I sent you last night, mm-hmm. I talk about this in that paper. But Hoagland called me up and he said, "Hey, Don," he said, "look, I know you're a former investigator." He said, I have a favor to ask. He said, "I heard that when NASA was brand new back in 60-61, that they contracted out to some think tank to write a position paper for them." He said, "I can't find anything out. Would you see if you could locate that?" So I started doing some investigation, and I found the paper in question that was prepared by the Brookings Institute. And I got that to Hoagland, and with the title and everything, he tracked down a copy of it. In the meantime, I tracked down a copy of it and started going through it. Now, in that paper, James, they state that there will be... Now, remember, this is circa 1961.
Okay.
That during the course of the space program, they expected to find either alien intelligence or alien artifacts, read extraterrestrial, somewhere within the solar system within the next 20 years. So what are we talking about by 1981-82?
Oh, okay, sorry, right.
Okay, now, they said, once we do that, not if, but when, then we come to a very difficult problem. Because according to these eggheads, two groups of people are going to be profoundly, the word they used, affected. Fundamentalists and scientists and engineers. Fundamentalists because of what it may do to their very fundamental belief of God, the universe, humanity, etc. And scientists and engineers that will show them how truly inept they are. So, what do we do? Do we have that discovery, or do we withhold?
Do you have this document?
Well, sure.
I've got to see this document.
Sure. Well,
but anyway, continue. I don't want to interrupt you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so at any rate, this is basically, I think...
This is a bona fide document.
Yes. Yes. It was prepared for NASA. So, what this basically did was set a template out there for how
protocol.
Yes, how NASA and God knows who else who was behind this, how they operate all the way up to today. Now, after I found that for Hoagland and McDaniel finished his report and presented it later, what happened with the Mars Observer? Just a couple of days out from Mars, it disappeared.
Was it Phobos 1 and Phobos 2?
Now, that was another case that I broke back in 1992. I interviewed Dr. Marina Popovich, General Pavel Popovich's ex-wife, who was not only a former cosmonaut, but also a record-breaking female aviator, one of the top in the world. She was over here, and I had a chance down in Arizona to interview her over a two-day period. Now, the Soviets, of course, by then, the Soviet Union was gone. But the former Soviets, as she told me back in the 70s and 80s, were going nuts over the UFO problem. They had turned the entire Russian army into a UFO reporting agency for about 10 years. And one of their objectives was if they could get their hands on this ET technology and break open and discover what made it tick, they could not only catch up to the West, read that the Americans, but probably surpass them. Now, the problem that she told me that they encountered was when these Soviet pilots tried to intercept these things, there were a number of hostile shootdowns. In other words, they were losing planes and pilots, and the Russians decided it was better to leave these damn things alone.
They flew rings around their fastest jets.
Oh my God, yes. And they've been doing since we first recognized the phenomenon going back to the end of World War II. So these are...
Where's this document?
Which one?
The one that talked about the implications if we did encounter something, the impact it would have on the fundamentals. And
after we finish the show, I'll get that to you, okay?
I would really appreciate that.
No problem. I will get that to you. Well, now, what's on your agenda now, James?
Well, we are currently working on, we want to capitalize on all this momentum right now. With out of the blue, and so we're thinking about having an event at some point in the next few months, which I can go into more detail later about. So we're kind of putting that together, but I'm also contacting all the ABC and CBS and NBC, and trying to secure a broadcast deal that possibly could coincide with an event that we're putting on. So we're definitely, we're keeping the momentum moving forward. And like I said, I'd love to talk more detail about our plans, but now may not be the best time. But there's more to come. Let's put it that way.
Well, I'll tell you what. I think everybody here is going to be looking forward with great interest to seeing what develops out of this. The name of this documentary, Out of the Blue, and this is how you can find out more about it. Get on your computer, open up your browser, and go up to outoftheblue.com. One more time, outoftheblue.com, all one word, .com. And if you are media, get on outoftheblue.com. Send James a note. There's a way to contact him in there. Tell him what organization you are with. James will send you the documentary gratis, so you can get a chance to see it, review it. And boy, I tell you, you can't do any better than that, James.
Yeah, no, I know. I'll even pay postage.
There we go. Well, look.
Nothing to lose and everything to gain.
This has been an absolutely fascinating view, and I want to take this opportunity first to invite you back as soon as you have more that you can talk about.
I think in August we're going to be releasing some information.
Okay.
Matter of fact, I know that in August we will be releasing information.
Well, that is outstanding. James, this has been absolutely phenomenal. It's been a great pleasure. Like I said, I cannot give this documentary a high enough rating. This thing was truly outstanding.
Well, Don, I really, really, truly appreciate your support. It means a lot to me. And like I said, I mean, our ultimate goal is to get this information out to the public and to the media, and let it be known that this phenomenon is something real.
Well, not only is it something real, but it has the potential of having profound implications for all of humanity. Okay, that is it for this edition of Dark Matters. Now, let me give you a little teaser. Many of you that have been tuning in to me for years know that I have always had a fascination with the supernatural. It's fun. It's fascinating. The real stuff is even a little bit scary. Now, you also know that I have written a novel called Past Sins, a novel of supernatural horror. Now, in that book, in Chapter 5, I talk about a allegedly real case that took place in the United Kingdom, in England, at a place called Highgate Cemetery, which was a Victorian cemetery, and some very heavyweight folks are buried in there, not the least of which is Karl Marx, the father of Marxism, socialism, communism. Michael Faraday, if you know anything about electricity, that name should ring a bell, and a lot of other folks. But in the late 60s, there was allegedly a genuine vampire that cropped up there. BBC was all over it for a number of years. A number of people came to the forefront, both for and the idea that there was an actual vampire. Well, I am going to be interviewing one of the principals about that case, and we'll tell you more about it when it happens, but let me tell you this. There is some surprising and shocking information about to come out. So that's it for this week. My name is Don Ecker, the show Dark Matters Radio, and we'll see you next time.
This is the Patriots Brigade Radio Network, waging war on the Matrix of Confusion.